Good afternoon. Hello. Can I have your attention, please? We'd like to get started if you could all quiet for just a minute. My name is Willie Ader, and I'm a member of the Middle East Forum Board of Governors. Before I introduce our distinguished speaker, David Frum, I would like to take just a few minutes to tell you about the forum's important work and encourage you to join our efforts. But first, let me thank David Stone and Wael Gotshal for being so kind as to host another event. The Middle East Forum, led by its director, Daniel Pipes, has consistently demonstrated a timely and critical understanding of issues, such as the threats posed by militant Islam and the parlous state of Middle East studies in North America. As an example of the Forum's ability to accurately predict events before they happen, let me quote Charles Krauthammer. During the decades when America slept, Pipes was among the very first to understand the dangers of Islamic radicalism. In his many writings, he identified it, explained its roots, including most notably Wahhabism as practiced and promoted by Saudi Arabia, and warned of its plans to infiltrate and make war on the United States itself. There are many more examples that I could give that would demonstrate both the value and the consistency of the Forum's many projects, but that would take all day. However, there is one other example worth mentioning. The Boston Globe wrote that had the world heeded Pipes' warning, September 11, 2001 would never have happened. It is exactly this type of reputation that recently led to Daniel Pipes' presidential appointment to the board of the United States Institute of Peace. And as further evidence of Middle East Forum's vitality, let me note that the Forum's four websites attract the highest number of visitors for sites providing Middle East-focused analysis. It is in this spirit that I encourage all of you here this afternoon to support the Forum's important activities. Such support will enable Middle East Forum to continue making an impact on public policy and increasing the public's understanding of one of the least understood regions of the world. Now on to our program for today. It is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, David Frum. But before I do, let me ask that you please switch off all cell phones and pagers and hold your questions and comments until the end of the program when the Forum's director, Daniel Pipes, will conduct a question and answer session. Mr. Frum, a former presidential speechwriter known for coining the axis of evil phrase, is a resident fellow at the American Institute for Public Policy Research and also serves as a contributing editor at the Weekly Standard. He is the author of The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. In his most recently published book, An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror, which is available outside, Mr. Frum delivers a manual for victory as he and co-author Richard Perl urge a new commitment to security at home, a new audacity in our strategy abroad, and a new boldness in the advocacy of American ideals. In particular, they recommend that Washington abandon support for a Palestinian state and undertake various policy steps with a view to bringing down Iran's hardline Islamist government. Winning the war on terror requires immediate and ongoing preventive action to neutralize existing and looming strategic threats to American security. I could go on at length about the valuable contribution to public debate this book has sparked, but know you will enjoy hearing from our illustrious speaker. Please join me in welcoming David Frum.
Thank you all. I too would like to thank the Wael Gotshal firm for their hospitality. I'd like to thank Daniel Pipes for much more than hospitality. Daniel was a guide and teacher to all of us in the White House who had to struggle with a very unfamiliar set of issues after 9/11. I was originally hired as a speechwriter to work on the grand, what we all assumed was going to be the grand initiative of the Bush administration, the reform of Social Security and Medicare. That was the thing that has persuaded me to go work for government, was there was going to be a chance to roll out these issues. I'd read the papers, but I'd never had any special interest in the Middle East before, and certainly not in the problem of terrorism. But then some jolting events caught my attention, as they did all of yours. And in that moment, we all turned to guidance. And Daniel was an extraordinarily important teacher. I only wish we had heard, listened to him sooner and harder. I do know, and I hope I'm not telling tales out of school, that the White House had under many administrations, a rather promiscuous attitude towards the people who were invited inside its gates. Well, it's a big place with a lot of rooms, and not all of the meetings in there are really quite as important as the people who bring the, you know, packs of matches and presidential M&Ms out would have their friends believe. But there were people there who ought not to have been there, and Daniel was an extraordinarily important guide and influence on making sure that, while I would not say the White House has yet attained perfection on this, in this regard, that the people who really ought not to be there really cease to come there. And I think it is a tremendous honor for that, among many other accomplishments. Now, as was mentioned, the reaction to the book that Richard and I wrote has been loud. It's not always enthusiastic. One of the lunch guests mentioned to me that he had seen a review which I hadn't seen, which referred to my co-author and myself as neoconservatives on crack. I can't speak for my co-author. From my point of view, actually, given that my mood-altering substance of choice is California Cabernet, switching to crack would be a very substantial economy move. I have to say I'm a little surprised at this middle-aged age to find myself having to accept the term neoconservative. I never thought I was one. In fact, my attitude toward this title is based on an old joke. I'm sure many of you here will know it, about the man standing on a commuter platform in Darien, Connecticut, reading the Wall Street Journal as he waited for the train to bring him out of town. And an older woman came up to him and tugged on the sleeve of his coat and said, "Mr. Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but may I ask you a personal question?" And the man pulls his eyes away from the newspaper and says, "Very well, go if you must, go ahead. What is it?" "So, I have to ask you, are you Jewish?" And the man says, no, I'm not. The man returns my paper. "Now, no, you're absolutely sure?" And this joke goes on through 19 iterations, on both sides and so on. And he has an increasing irritation. "Madam, I assure you that I have the greatest admiration and respect for the Jewish people. If I were Jewish, I would cheerfully say so. It just so happens I'm the vestryman of the First Episcopal Church of Darien, and I am not Jewish." And so on and so on through 19 more iterations. So finally, under repeated nagging, he cracks and says, all right, have it your way, I am Jewish." And she replies, "That's funny, you don't look Jewish." And my reaction is, I never thought of myself as being a neoconservative, and suddenly I discover I'm speaking neoconservative and have to accept the title, and so I do. I am here today to talk to you about the content and ideas in An End to Evil, but I am not going to try to cram what is a very specific and detailed book into 20 minutes. We can maybe deal with some of the issues in the question and answer period. I want to maybe take a step back and bring you up to date with maybe some things that could be added to this debate that we began with An End to Evil in the period since the book was finished and since it's come out. And in particular, I have to bring to you a report from a savage, blood-soaked land riven by tribal feuds and riven by tribal feuds and murderous hatreds, and that, of course, is Washington, D.C. The mood that led Richard and me to begin An End to Evil is, I think, even stronger now than it was on the day we began our collaboration not quite a year ago. And that is that we were moved by alarm at the collapse of the national consensus that had emerged after 9/11, the national consensus against the easy, careless ways of the 1990s, the national consensus that said strong measures have to be taken. We have to understand terrorism as a war. It is not a law and order problem. It is not like the drug trade. It is an attempt to destroy as improbable as that sounds, as an attempt to destroy and overthrow American society and open the way for a new kind of totalitarian despotism to fasten itself on a fifth of our fellow human creatures. That consensus, which prevailed after 9/11 and lasted until both the war in Iraq began to be seriously planned and until the 2004 election cycle began to get underway, is really, it's corroding by the minute. And this is not just a matter of party politics, because the debate over how to think about terrorism and how to approach it has historically been, and even now remains, a debate as much within parties as between them. And the forces for advocating the old, failed way are as strong inside the Republican Party as they are outside it, and as strong inside the Democratic Party as they are outside it. I can speak, since the Republican Party is in power right now, maybe those internal forces of opposition inside the Republican Party are, if anything, even more important than the Democratic opposition. But the story, in many ways, of what President Bush has tried to do since 9/11 is, to my mind, the best analogy is to think of it as, it's like a moon launch. It's like the attempt to take an extraordinarily heavy object and throw it beyond Earth's gravity. And the faster the object tries to move and the higher it rises, the more dangerous the gravitational forces on that object trying to bring it crashing back to where it began become. And the list of those forces is really, when you itemize them, it's daunting. It's daunting. You have, for example, all the routine forces of bureaucratic inertia, which is nothing to dismiss. Agencies that would have to change their ways, agencies that might have to go out of business, agencies that might have to accept the leadership of some other agency, which has always been their real rival, like the old joke about the young naval officer who makes the mistake one day of referring in a superior hearing to the Soviets as the enemy, and he's quickly chastised, no, the Soviets are our adversary, the Air Force is the enemy. the CIA and FBI have for many, many years thought this in the same kinds of ways. So have the various services within the Army. Donald Rumsfeld nearly lost his job in the first 9 months of the Bush administration because of his belief that in the days when an aircraft traveling at twice the speed of sound can hurl an object with perfect precision within hours at any distance from the United States, in such a time, it may be a little bit unnecessary to have a gigantic upgrade of a Napoleonic artillery piece hauled into a C-5 plane, lowered onto a highway, and shooting howitzer shells. But as he quickly discovered, that what he regarded as an obsolete piece of ordnance was regarded by many other people as an essential item of their personal retirement security. He nearly lost his job in the fight over this gigantic howitzer called the Challenger. That story can be written large all over Washington. There is, of course, the fact that the United States has had an alliance of convenience for more than half a century with the Saudi monarchy. And that monarchy has been very generous at remembering its many friends, many and ever more numerous friends, and that too has an impact on Washington life. So too does the feeling of the kind of conservatism that in many ways one could respect and even admire, of a preference for existing evils over unknown ones. The Bush program has been a program, and the program of saying that the evil of the old ways has become so unbearable that we have to try something new, fully understanding that a new approach may also have risks and consequences and challenges. And the program that Richard Perlmutter and I lay out in An End to Evil is the whole generation beyond anything that has been explicitly advocated by this administration. It's that much older, it's that much stronger, and it in turn opens up that many more risks. And there are people in Washington who believe that risk is something you want to shut down. There is the normality of presidential politics, and there is finally the fact that in this vast, gigantic country, where the rest of the world seems so far away, that it's always possible to feel that the conflicts that occur within the borders of the country, and especially within the capital city, are more real than anything happening beyond it. And so, as we fight these battles in Washington over what the future of American foreign policy should be, there are many, many people who are on the other side of these fights, on the side that has not had the upper hand, who see the chance to get revenge on their opponents, the people they call the neocons. They see that as much more valuable than, and much more precious and real than winning any battle in Iraq, which is a country they've never seen, far away, and can hardly believe impinges on them directly. These are, this is the map, and this is why there has been, this is why you can feel, as I think many of you will feel, a kind of vitality and energy daily going out of this war. That the mood, if you will pick up a magazine or a newspaper of, never mind even the immediate aftermath of 9/11, but for the year and a half afterwards, you can read Americans making promises to themselves about things that would never happen. We will never forget. We will never return to the old ways. We will never succumb to false and easy moral equivalents. We will never allow complacency and fear of change to shackle us to policies that have proven themselves wrong. And one by one by one, those nevers are falling away, and every one of the bad old habits is reasserting itself. And the question, and you can see it, you can see the ideas running out, you can see there are very few, aside from what we play out in the book, and neither of us is part of the government, there are very few new ideas being generated in Washington by the people who believe that that the war has set forward momentum. I mean, everything that one hears and sees in Washington is a mood of let us muddle through in Iraq as best we can, try to reach some kind of end game. That end game gets more and more modest. It's as if the administration is conceding to its opponents that our only objective here is to get out of this place as rapidly as possible, and that all the reasons, that the real reasons that led the United States in, which are not just to find bombs and weapons, but to change the most potentially most important country in the Arab Middle East in a way that offers a positive example, in the way that Taiwan has offered a positive example to the Chinese-speaking Far East, that could offer a positive speaking example to the Arabic-speaking Middle East, that the ideals that by which Americans live and Europeans and increasingly people in East Asia and Latin America, they can have some relevance to you, and that the answer to your problems is not murdering people and crashing planes into buildings. That impetus is fading. Well, Americans are problem-solving people, and I think when I talk to a group like this one and say that this impetus for forward momentum is fading, the natural question you have is, so what do we do about it? And I share that. I think that's exactly. I think this is when you see something going wrong, the right thing to do is not to be pessimistic and depressed and to say things are going wrong. The right thing to do is to say, okay, so how do we fix this problem? And that's what I want to talk to you about today, finally. And this is an idea that is not included in the book, but is, I think, where the book is building to. The great belief that motivated Richard and me in the writing of this book was that in the end, that the power that would drive an expansion, that would drive the forward momentum of the war, was not any one administration, however much Richard and I may support this particular president, because administrations are subject to all those gravitational forces and all the inertia I talked about. Not an administration, certainly not any kind of bureaucracy or institution. It would be the demand of the country for action, the memory of the country that it was in danger, and because I don't think this is the wrong way to think, and I especially don't think it's wrong in your memory of Americans, that they have been bloodied and wounded and injured and humiliated, and that the wrongs this country suffered on this great battlefield of the war on terror on this very island, that the wrongs of the country have not yet been avenged, and that they have to be avenged. That's just not just a matter of safety, that is a matter of self-respect. That it is a country that has to be called into the equation. And until now, up until maybe this year, the balance was the country's attitude seemed to be those people who trusted and followed the president against those people who weren't so sure. Now, in this election year, you have a battle between those people angry at and hate the president and those people who hope he knows what he's doing. But the idea that you can call public opinion into the equation as a force in itself and an agent that demands action and prosecution of the war, that the public can be the radicalizing force, that's something whose potential we haven't explored yet. There are, of course, many ways for the public to have an influence on the space, and the Middle East Forum is one of the finest and most important of them. But the Middle East Forum does its business in the realm of ideas, and in fact, I think there'd be some pretty severe tax consequences for you if you do that differently. But there ought to be a way for people who really are concerned about the danger and threat of terrorism to the United States, not just to Israel, not just to the countries in the region, but to the United States, to play directly in the political sphere. What people can do, of course, is they can take a look at the candidates, especially the candidates for high office, and pick the one that they think is best or least bad, and support them, and that's very valuable. And they can support individual congressmen and extract individual pledges from them. But I'm beginning to think that what is maybe necessary here is something very like the group, the Political Club for Growth, that some of you may have heard of, maybe some of you are involved with, which is a group of business leaders in New York who pool resources behind, in any given term, not very many, 20 or 25 congressional candidates who, regardless of party, have what they regard as the right attitude toward taxes and economic policy. And something like that may need to be organized in the realm of foreign policy. AIPAC does this from a very narrow vantage point, but not since the end of the Cold War, and not even really since the early days of the Cold War, have there been citizens groups organized directly to participate in politics, asking only one question: which of these candidates is going to do the things that are necessary to secure the country at home and abroad, to bring about the right kind of solution and endgame in Iraq, to continue to prosecute the conflict in Iran, to speak candidly and truthfully about what is happening in Saudi Arabia, to do the things at home in the area of domestic security that so badly need doing, and that are actually at the moment probably more in danger than anything else. And the Patriot Act comes up for reauthorization in 2005, and a number of important political figures have just as they thoughtlessly voted for it in 2001, without really knowing what's in it, so in 2005 they've now come out against it after it's proved its value, again, with no seeming greater knowledge of what's in it. This is not a blueprint, but it is a thought that is increasingly uppermost in my mind, that what is needed now, Richard and I tried to lay out a kind of program, but what is needed now is not just to debate this program, but for citizens who find the program interesting and worthwhile to directly participate, not through the medium of a presidential candidate, but directly participate in political life to make, through their contributions, to their work, through going on the airwaves, through campaigning, through stuffing envelopes, through doing all of the things that citizens and democracy do to make their government respond, enter and participate directly, to make their weight felt and to demand and deserve victory. And I thank you, and I'm going to take questions.
Thank you, David, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your kind words, and Willie Ayers as well. It's awfully good to be at this meeting. It's been, I think, 7 months since I've been at a Middle East briefing. David has given us an overview of the situation, of a fairly depressing one, that things are going awry. Do you hear me now?
Yes.
David's given us a fairly depressing assessment of the situation with a coda. And it strikes me that from the beginning that we've not had any citizens groups. The name escapes me, but there's a very important one in the late 30s, early 40s to mobilize for war against the Nazis. Was it Duffy White that was?
William Allen White.
William Allen White.
The Citizens Committee to Defend America by Aiding the Allies.
There you go. Citizens Committee for Defending America by Aiding the Allies. And it was a truly powerful force, and we've had nothing of that. I thought for a while that William Bennett's Americans for Victory Over Terrorism would turn into that, but didn't really. So, yes, it's a great idea, I think. Let me ask you a question to start things out. It occurs to me that there's a pattern that begins with the grand figure of Winston Churchill, who imprecated against British policy and French policy and the German Nazi state, and got exactly nowhere until the fall of France. Then we have, say, the figure of Ronald Reagan and those who were with him, who got nowhere during the late 1970s. Until the invasion of Afghanistan. And to take another democracy of those who railed against the Oslo process in Israel. Got nowhere until the violence, what's called the Second Intifada, erupted in September of 2000. And then Ariel Sharon came in. I originally thought that September 11th marked that kind of a date for us, that it was akin to the fall of France, the invasion of Afghanistan, or the eruption of the Second Intifada. As time goes on, I wonder if it really was that. If, in fact, we are not waiting for something actually much more awful. That was a curtain call, but it wasn't the event that will transform American consciousness and make us aware. I've got this process, education by murder. It's only when substantial numbers of people are killed that the survivors learn the lesson. It's not a smart way of learning, but at least it is a way of learning. I wonder if the analogous event, or this, I don't think Pearl Harbor fits it, but the others I think fit it quite well. If there is something analogous, if you think that it might, if you agree with my growing notion that September 11th is not that, and that if there is to be such a thing, it is to be in the future.
That's an even more depressing question. I think you're quoting the line of Benjamin Franklin, that experience is a hard teacher, but fools will have no other. But look, if 9/11 is not enough to jolt the country awake, it's hard to imagine what that event would be. And it's kind of, it would be a terrible reflection on the United States if an event as awful as that were not enough. That really ought to be enough. That really ought to be enough. And here's where I'm not a pessimist. I think it is enough. I think it is enough. And the reason I am not fundamentally pessimistic about how things will ultimately resolve themselves is because I think that it is still true that now that while the grief has passed, and while the immediate shock and terror have passed, the two things that remain true in the population are, one, a deep sense of insecurity that is a real, often not always spoken of, but a real force, and second, a lingering sense of humiliation, that this remains an that nothing has yet happened, not even the overthrow of Saddam, that is proportional to what was done. And that Americans, you know, Americans are not people who satisfy themselves with a partial vindication. They want the whole measure. And I think that mood is still there in the public. It requires to be mobilized and tapped. Now, President Bush has done, in many ways, a very good job of this. And certainly what happened in Iraq is a very, very big thing. And if followed through, it could be an even bigger thing. I mean, Iraq certainly began by sending a message. One of the things I've learned from you is when you try to understand, well, what did Osama bin Laden and the jihadists, what did they think they were doing? What did they think they would achieve? One of the things they thought they would achieve is expose to their potential followers the ultimate weakness of the United States. At a minimum, what you can say is that it set in motion that what the events in Iraq have done is shown the constituency of Osama bin Laden saw the real strength of the United States. That is, it will show that if the United States wins in Iraq. If it loses, it will have a very negative message. But one of the things that I think you take away from, there's a story, I have no idea if it's true, I'm sure it's not true, but I don't want to check it because it's too valuable a story to lose to mere truth. But there's a story about John F. Kennedy, who was a senator, who was very interested in intelligence matters, and he used to pass by the then new, as a senator, he would often pass by the then new CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, which had a big sign out in front, "Welcome to Langley, Virginia, headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency." And Kennedy had kind of an idea this was maybe inappropriate sign to proposition in front of America's Secret Service, and he resolved as soon as he became president, one of the first things he would do would be to get rid of the sign. He becomes president, he takes the oath, and he goes to the Oval Office, and they go through the first day's work, and he says, "Oh, and by the way, I want the sign down in front of the CIA." What quickly emerges is that the sign was not put up by the federal government, but by the Virginia Department of Highways. and it's a major left turn off a certain route, and they decided it was a safety measure. And he struggled, and he struggled, and he struggled, and the punchline of the story is he's still there. There are real limits to what presidents can do, even in the realm of foreign policy. And certainly, since so much of this struggle involves domestic security and therefore laws and therefore the courts, there are even greater limits to what presidents can do. So my mind increasingly turns on, look, the mood is there, the public is right, all the things, the public does not need a bigger lesson. It's got the message. It just needs to know, what do we do? What do we do? And one of the things that was very true at the White House after 9/11 was you were just overwhelmed with citizens demanding to know what they could do. And the White House was a little baffled by this. And under the prodding of some of the political people, they came up with various, semi-cynical strategies like the volunteering and donating blankets and joining, court. None of these things had anything real to do with the problem of terrorism. But the demand of what can we do is real. And as I've been paying more and more attention to the way to the changes in American politics made possible by the new campaign finance laws. These laws are, in many ways, things I don't welcome, but as you look at them, they still open up extraordinary ability for citizens to participate directly in the job of forming public opinion. And George Soros has been one of the first people to realize this, in my mind, very much for the worse. But what he has discovered is that it's now possible for citizens to take money, as much as they want, put it into a committee called a 529 committee, specially authorized under the law, and so long as that committee does not coordinate its actions with a political party, it is free to make advertisements and to broadcast, can't advocate the election or defeat of a particular candidate, but it can have a huge impact on the public debate. That's a possible thing to do. It's also possible because of the increase in the amount of money that you can now give a candidate, from $1,000 per person to $2,000 per person, $4,000 for a couple. If you've got a couple of children under the age of 18, you can make donations on their behalf. You can then, it's very hard to raise that kind of money, but if people make it their business to raise that money in advance and have it waiting there in a pool and save candidates the work, so that can be a very powerful thing if a candidate knows that if he is able to create a platform that meets the concerns of a group of people who have gone to the trouble of raising his money for him, that can have a very clarifying effect and create in Congress a constituency that demands swift and direct and decisive and large action. The Patriot Act may be the first battle of this. The way Iraq reconstruction goes may be the first battle. I can't predict. It may be battles over how deep into the Saudi connection is the 9/11 Commission allowed to go. I don't know what exactly the issues will be, but there is a potential. The citizenry at large, important sections of elite opinion, they're ready for this. They just have not yet found the way to organize and bring themselves together to have a direct impact on politics. And as I think about I've written a lot of books, and I've been thinking about writing another one, and as I keep rotating in my mind, would I write another? This is the question that talk show hosts who haven't read your previous book ask, will you write, are you working on another book, and why? Will you read that one? You get asked that question a lot on the talk show circuit, but as I've encountered that question again and again, my answer is increasingly clear in my own mind that I'm not sure that what the world needs now is another book on terrorism. We understand it, thanks to you and thanks to Bernard Lewis and thanks to many others. We do understand it. And the point now, the job now, is to do something about it.
I'm trying to understand the process that we're going through right now versus, let's say, the Cold War. Okay? And we had a lot of misconceptions about the Cold War, such as we are too strong. And eventually, after Russia sort of deteriorated. So my question is, how would you answer to those critics that says, well, we are really overstating the case because look at Russia, for example?
Yeah. If you took a walk through downtown Hamburg in the summer of 1945 and looked at all of the piles of rubble around you, you might well say, how did we ever get the idea that these folks could trouble the peace of the world? But things look rather different after you know the outcome than when you know it. The greatest The greatest mistake in history is to write history backwards. To write it saying, well, we know how it turned out, therefore we know how it was at the start. There was no guarantee that the Cold War had to turn out the way it did. Yeah, Russia was, compared to the United States, economically weak. So were the Visigoths compared to ancient Rome. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, it certainly is the precondition. It's the precondition for a lot of things. But if the United States of 1947 had the same ideas and habits of mind as the United States of 1936, the Soviets would have got a lot farther into Western Europe than they did. Their goal in the Cold War always was, and this is maybe more of a historical answer than I should give, was can we find some way to get the annex the money of Western Europe to our, they knew perfectly well how economically backward they were. That's why they needed to occupy Western Europe in order to acquire the wealth to carry out their scheme. It could have happened. It could have happened. And yet, there's maybe another way to think about it that is, I think, cheering, and it offers, for example, what the kind of goal we should be pursuing is. We were talking before that I began about college campuses. Young Gerald Ford, when he was at Yale Law School just before Pearl Harbor, was a member or was involved with the America First movement, the isolationists. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and he joined the Navy, and he served in the Navy, and he returned from the Navy, and got married, and opened up a little law practice, went back home to Grand Rapids, the Grand Rapids area, and became interested in politics. He was a father, a Republican, like as his family had been before him. But although he had gone away to the East as an isolationist, very much in the Michigan tradition, he returned to Michigan as an interventionist. And in 1948, he entered a Republican primary against the sitting isolationist congressman, beat him, won the Republican nomination, and entered Congress as an internationalist Republican, one who understood that the United States had to uphold the defense of the world. And that is... So we have to go through a similar kind of transition of mind where just as young Gerald Ford had to wake up to the fact that what happened in Czechoslovakia mattered to the safety and security of people in Grand Rapids. And that was a really new thought in Grand Rapids. So we have to wake up to the idea that what happens not just on the borders of the countries of the Middle East, but inside the countries of the Middle East matters to our security. We have to wake up to also the idea that, as in the Cold War, the United States cannot take for granted the loyalty of all of the people resident inside its borders. And we look back now on this and say, how could people have ever held such barbaric and cruel and McCarthyite beliefs and ever to question the fact that not all of the people inside the United States were loyal to them? But you know, there were hundreds of communist agents inside the United States, and many of them at very high levels of power. That was even more true in Britain. As I mentioned, Czechoslovakia was to the cost of the Czechs. Czechoslovakia did not fall to the Red Army. It fell to a coup. Now, nothing like that is exactly going to happen, but all the democratic countries today have internal problems that are as great as the external threat, and this, too, requires new habits of mind. And maybe, finally, one way in which this is like the early days of the Cold War, that at the beginning of 9/11, there was a lot of talk of the need for sacrifice. And that, by that, which was usually a euphemism for higher taxes. But it seems to me the sacrifice that is most urgently required is the sacrifice of obsolete ideas. And I'll tell you, in Washington, people part with their money a lot faster than they will part with obsolete ideas. And one of the things that has been sort of discouraging to me is I would have thought with Daniel that the complete... total, violent, public proof that an idea is a catastrophic failure would be enough to describe it a little bit. But it turns out that that's not entirely the case.
Actually, what you just said leads into the question I wanted to ask, is that another thing you have to give up an awful lot of ideas and adopt other ones. And how can that be achieved? For example, the notion that maybe Islam as a religion is not exactly the kind that, you know, that is necessarily equal to God with any other religion. And they show that there are a handful of people who are masters within it, but that basically it's perfectly okay. And there are a number of other ideas like that. People have a right to say what they want to say. I mean, just look at the campuses nuclear goose or thing with it. I don't want to take time for that. What I'm saying is, how are you going to fight some entrenched ideas of how we think people are?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that old notion that they're really good at heart.
All right. Well, I'm no kind of expert on Islam. What I would say is that I attend services, not Jewish religious services, not quite every week, but most weeks. And when you listen to the Bible reading, you will find there are plenty of passages in the Jewish Bible that can make your blood run cold. And you can well imagine that if history had gone a little differently, that the world might be saying, well, gee, look at what's in the book of Leviticus, look what's in the book of Joshua, that's terrifying stuff. Religions are what people make of them. Now, I do tend to think that people in important ways are broadly similar to one another. And the question is, why in the contemporary world do so many Muslims choose to fasten on the horrific parts of the Quran, rather than, as Christians and Jews do with the disturbing parts of their holy books, ignore them, pretend they're not there, sort of skip lightly over them without in any way being influenced over them, while on their way to the other passages. But about the point of ideas, where I very much agree with you, there is, I think, very much in a lot of the discussion of terrorism. I've been using a lot of lame jokes to illustrate points, but you know the children's joke about the question, the riddle, how do you get down off an elephant? And the answer is you don't get down off an elephant, you get down off a duck. And I think that has been the main appeal of the Palestinian peace process idea, which is from Washington, that as daunting as the Palestinian problem may be in reality, as daunting as it looks from the vantage point of Israel, from Washington it looks like, you know, not that big a problem. It's a problem, you know, you move a line here, you write a check for some billions or tens of billions of dollars, which is small change in the American political context, and, you know, you've got a problem. It's one of the things you often hear in Washington, is everyone knows how to solve this problem. The main outlines of the problem, we all agree about what they are. You've got the border here, you do this with Jerusalem, this is what happens to the garbage pickup, problem solved. It's just a question of, you know, making the deal. I think one of the reasons why so many in Washington are drawn to this idea is because if it were wrong, then you'd have a really, really big and difficult problem. When you have a big and difficult problem, you have to do something. And so you begin with the conclusion, well, we don't want to do anything. Therefore, we can't see the problem. Therefore, we have to recognize some other problem because we're ready to do the solution to that problem.
To come back to religion,
yeah.
We had 9/11, which was a horrendous event. What puzzles me is it would be so simple to leave a little package in Bloomingdale that's that all around every city. You don't even need a suicide bomber to it. And the impact of that in this world is extraordinary, would be tremendous. Now, why has that not occurred?
Well, the good news is the mere fact that it has not occurred tells us that it's harder than it seems. And I think I've often had this thought. Here's an example. The example I had was for a year after 9/11, for more than a year, the White House would have all these tremendous security procedures. You were checked, you had new kinds of badges with all kinds of, you know, special identifiers in there. Of course, everything had to be go through a metal detector. And what would happen every day after as these security procedures were put in place is after lunch, dozens, even hundreds of people would go for lunch. They'd pick up a sandwich. They'd pick up a cup of Starbucks coffee. They would return. They would go to the metal detector. They would put their cup of Starbucks coffee down here. They would walk to the metal detector. They would pick up that cup of Starbucks coffee and continue. Now, government workers are on pretty tight salaries, but some of those people must have bought the 20-ounce dispenser, which contained as much plastic, which could contain as much plastic explosive as brought down the jet over Lockerbie. So they're doing everything. They're not screening the Starbucks coffee. And yet, so you look at that from the point of view of someone who does not feel that the authorities are looking for him, who speaks English, who knows how things work, who has credit cards, who has a driver's license, and you think, boy, would it ever be easy to smuggle some plastic explosive into this building? And you forget that maybe it doesn't look that way to the actual potential malefactor. It does turn out to be harder than it seems. It must be because it hasn't happened. Also, I think the administration is right when it says that it is making good progress breaking apart these terrorist networks overseas. The number of real brains in these organizations may turn out to be smaller than we think. And one example of that, you've all heard the story of how the 93 World Trade Center plot was broken because the poor fool went to pick up his deposit on the ride of rent truck. Well, the reason the poor fool did that was because he had thought there was an arrangement made to get him out of the country afterwards. And only after he sort of clued in on him, no, he was being left behind. And the reason he did not have enough money even to pay for an airfare. So he had to return the car to get the deposit to buy himself an air ticket to get out of the country because he'd been written off. The number of people who really count is not that big. And if you can kill or disable a dozen or two dozen of them, it seems to have happened, you make an impact, at least for this generation. Now, you can always say more.
Let me suggest an alternate reading, which is that violence is not necessarily productive. I think we can make a good argument that you have made it, that the United States is better prepared post 9/11 than before, and that therefore 9/11 was counterproductive. Yes, it killed people and harmed the economy, but from the point of view of making war in the United States, it's actually counterproductive. And probably the dispatch of bombs here and there in fashionable department stores would have the same counterproductive effect, which is also implied that there are other ways of going about the same business, which are not using violence. The sort of people you alluded to who were led into the White House in years past, there's a political process, there's a political means of achieving these same goals that may be more effective than this terroristic one. In the back.
Speaking of old ideas that you perhaps disposed of, can you address the issue of the deservedness of
Are the Palestinians entitled to a state? Well, it's probably not a very productive line of thought. I mean, if you ask me in my private view, is it justified? I have to say, I think it's probably the worst cause that has ever commanded the sympathy of the world. But a lot of bad causes have gone pretty far. I mean, I'm just reading right now a book about the creation of Pakistan in 1948 and what a mistake partition was, and how, in fact, just about every literate person in Pakistan actually kind of agreed. And if you go through, no one really wanted it. It just sort of happened. It was terrible because people were intransigent and not visionary enough. The demand for this is kind of a fact. You can certainly make arguments about it. I don't know whether at this point the most productive way to deal with this problem is to deal with the question of whether or not the Palestinians deserve a state. I think maybe when you talk about it, certainly from an American point of view, one of the questions is such a state in the interest of the United States? Never mind the matters of deserve. What Richard and I argue, Richard and I have slightly different views on this question, and so the book takes a middle line between our thoughts on it. But whether or not it would make sense for the United States actively to oppose such a thing if it were to be negotiated by the parties, the way it will actually probably happen, the way in the late 1990s it was actually contemplated to happen, with the United States would midwife the creation of a state, of a Palestinian state, fully recognizing that important sections of Palestinian public opinion would reject the compromises that the state would have to sign in order to get its right to life. And that the United States, and many people, in fact, as there was recently, you'll remember where this article appeared, I forget, but two members of the Clinton negotiating team laid out a new plan that said, let's go back to this process, go back to where we were in 2000, and make more explicit the idea that we're going to need an American security force inside the Palestinian territory to help the Palestinian Authority against more radical elements within the Palestinian population. Well, here's a plan. If you're worried that the United States is unpopular in the Islamic world because the United States is not supporting the aspirations of the Palestinians, and the solution to this is to put American soldiers in the middle of a shooting war between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, and to help a corrupt and incompetent Palestinian Authority hunt down and lock up people who would be regarded throughout much of the Islamic world as the true heroes of the Palestinian cause. I mean, this is not a formula for popularity. It is, in my mind, a formula for creating a Palestinian South Vietnam, a regime that actually cannot command the support of its own people. And so, simply from, you know, leaving dessert aside, from the practical view of, is it in the American interest to create such a thing, it's very easy to have a formula that, where you say, where you can imagine a certain, the right kind of Palestinian faith being at least not harmful. But when you look at where things are now, how things are likely to go, it seems to me that, that most of the that doing such a thing in the immediate future is probably going to involve the United States, certainly in a great deal of expense and possibly in a great deal of danger, with very little reward. I'm not sure that I'd want to single out individuals by name, and partly because of just a recognition of the way small group dynamics work, which is one of the things that is sort of odd. You don't think it will be this way, but even at very high levels of government, people can enter into meetings and come out saying exactly the opposite of the thing they went in saying, and sometimes they even forget that they don't even realize that they've been turned around. I think a lot of it, I think that one of the weaknesses of the Bush administration is it does not have a strong National Security Council. It does not have a good mechanism for taking the disagreements that always occur between the different elements of the national security bureaucracy. They always occur and always should occur, that are healthy and useful and for the important to hear, and important for a president to hear. I mean, it is bad if he would only hear one kind of advice. He needs to take a range of views, but he needs a mechanism both for brokering those views, for arriving at a common, an agreed upon solution, and then enforcing it. And the way the Bush administration has tended to not be so successful is in saying, right, here's our policy, and it's compulsory, and the argument is over, and the policy stops. So it was incredible to me that Colin Powell recently gave an interview in which he said, yes, well, under all the circumstances, if I could look back on it, my views, my vote on the Iraq policy would have been different. That's something. If one were ever to say anything, I mean, that's an absurd thing to say. It's wrong. It's wrong for all kinds of reasons. But anyway, it's the kind of mistake that it's only the president's to make. That if an individual member of the cabinet feels the need to disassociate himself from something the president has done, then there's a way to do it, and it's called a resignation letter. You don't do it in an interview. And yet, the Bush administration is not coherent. And the explanation of why that hasn't happened is probably more technical and bureaucratic than anybody here would have patients to go to. It's not just a matter of personalities. It's the way hiring is done. It's got to do, well, one of the things I talk about in my book about President Bush, it's got to do sometimes with the strange idea that a lot of Republican administrations have, is that if you cannot deal with the fact that the U.S. government is spending close to $2 trillion a year, and you think that's too much, you want to reduce it, and you're not successful, but what you can do instead is try to save $50,000 here and there in your National Security Council budget. And so that they would often not pay people enough to attract the people they wanted. And by making a petty economy and refusing to pay a proper salary to a person outside government whom you wanted to bring in, you then create a situation where the State Department would say, well, look, why don't we send over one of our people to fill that chair? And that will show, that will cost nothing on the White House books. That will be a State Department cost. And you'll save, $50,000 or $80,000 at the cost, of course, of losing control of the political agenda in your foreign policy. And that is the kind of petty economy that this White House is not the first Republican White House to make. Does Sharon's talk of Israel moving out of Gaza make sense? I probably will disagree with Daniel about this. I think it does make sense. And I think it makes sense both on its own terms. It also makes sense that Israel does have a very, has a dual message that it needs to broadcast to the world. One at the same time, making it clear to its enemies that you cannot destroy it, that its will is strong, and of making it clear to its more weak-willed friends, however, it's a flexible country and willing to make peace on reasonable terms, always. And sending both of those messages at the same time is a very difficult thing to do, but it's a necessary thing for a country that is as small and basically weak as Israel is to do. And that this kind of this proposal on Gaza reminds people of the fundamental fact of Middle Eastern grammar, which is that there could be an agreement between Israel and its Arab neighbors tomorrow. There could have been an agreement yesterday. Since there's one party that has the ability to make peace, and any day it decides it wants peace, the peace arrives that same day.
Last question.
Yeah, just a comment on that. I mean, the policy that I was reading about the withdrawal from Gaza was not a complete withdrawal, it was a withdrawal of civilian settlements, but with a continued military presence until conditions would be for that exchange of peace. But the interfering factor is continuously radical Islam in the terroristic forms of Hamas and Jihad in Palestine. And of course, in the greater Middle East, as far as the United States is concerned. I was speaking, took some time to speak with Ishan Manji, a wonderful woman.
Well, from Antonio, I know her well.
Yeah. And we had a reception for her here, and I spent a long time talking to her. Question is, what can we do apart from fortifying ourselves in the way you're saying for this policy of defense by forward motion?
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to try and change the tenure of the instruction that people are getting in the madrasas, even of Canada and the madrasas even of the United States?
Yeah.
What can we do to get moderate Muslims to join in the struggle against radical Islam resources?
Well, what can we do? Well, we wrote a book to answer that question. I won't in my last 30 seconds give you a high-speed rendition of the whole book. But let me deal with one issue having to do with education, having to do with Irshad's concerns, which are important that we take up, which is under American law, if your institution of higher learning wants to have a ban on interracial dating, it can. If it's a private school, it can do so. But the law makes clear, this is the famous Bob Jones case, that you do not get the tax deduction for doing so. You have to pay your property taxes. You are not going to be regarded as the kind of philanthropic institution that deserves the special benefit of being exempt from the ordinary tax laws of any other kind of corporate body has. As far as the law is concerned, if you want, you can do it. It's a free country, but you're like a cigarette manufacturer. You have to pay your taxes, all of them. It seems to me that this approach that we take toward institutions that foment racial hatred is a promising approach for institutions that foment religious hatred, and that schools that teach hatred ought to pay their property taxes. They ought not to be the beneficiaries of tax deductions. That's just one thing. That's one sort of specific thing. And then on a more global level, but these schools in Pakistan and places like that are not paying their own bills. They are subsidized to the tunes of many billions of dollars a year by outside forces from the United States, from Saudi Arabia above all. And it ought to be a much more important part of American foreign policy than it is to break the fingers of the Saudis' hand to make them understand that it is not the act of a friend to write checks to teach the murder of Americans, and that this must stop. And that if it doesn't stop, that Saudi Arabia's claim to be a friend that it benefits from American military protection, that claim is going to be rejected.
Please join me in thanking you, Dick.
Thank you.
To remind you that his book is available, his co-authored book is available online. We look forward to your purchase of it. Thank David very much for coming to New York today and for addressing us with his robust and activist approach to dealing with our current problems. I very much endorse the idea that we must take this forward as citizens. It's not enough to allow the government to make these decisions for us, we must become actively involved. So again, thank you to all of you for joining us, and look forward to seeing you at the next Middle East briefing.
I've been looking at this idea for a while, but I don't see it.